Why do heathen mariners make it safely to shore, and the Hebrew prophet Jonah ends up in a fish? Hello, this is Doug Clark. Welcome to Probe. Some strange events in store for us on Probe this week as we continue our examination of the story of Jonah. The opening chapter tells us of primal fears, divine loading of the dice, rescue for the pagans, but not for the prophet. We're in for more surprises in the amazing book of Jonah. To help us explore this section of the book, I have again asked Drs. Alden Thompson and Beverly Beam of Walla Walla College to be my guests. To both of you, welcome to Probe.
Thanks.
I wonder if, Bev, it might be good to begin with some literary considerations. You have reminded us, and you remind students in your biblical literature classes, about the importance of literary features like repetition. Now, it seems to me that we have a lot of repetition in the book of Jonah, a good share of it observable really only from the Hebrew. In English translations, we don't like to repeat words. We want to use a synonym or something different. But in Hebrew, a lot of repetition. Talk to us about repetition, the value it had, and then let's look for some examples in this story, especially now that we're entering the story with the mariners.
Yeah. Well, you know, repetition comes through your eyes. You look at the page, but it also comes through the ear, and maybe even more effectively through the ear. And stories were told, not read. And
That's a good point, and probably worth emphasizing again that the people who first became aware of the story of Jonah heard it,
right.
And there are dynamics in the process of listening that make a story different or more complete, more holistic than just the quiet, silent, private reading.
I think that if we would read the story aloud to ourselves, to our families, as we study each week, that would add another impact in our understanding, another avenue for really engaging this text. And the idea of repetition, this is one of the things that you look for as you read over and over and over again. You become aware, oh, I've seen this idea before. The repetition of patterns that begin to form as you begin to see that certain dynamics are happening on a repeated level. Certain motifs are being developed. Like, for instance, just even the word great. God never lets us forget the greatness of that city. Go to Nineveh, that great city. And this idea of greatness just is worked out over and over again in many other things. Everything happens on a grand scale. There's a great fish, a great storm.
A great fear.
And Jonah responds to the plant that raises with great joy, and then when it dies, he has great anger. This is
a great book, don't you think?
Yes, it is. The idea of greatness is something we have to look at. Everything is larger than life. This is something that is actually establishing something about the dynamics that are happening between these characters. And another thing that happens with these dynamics is that I think we mentioned last time that the dialogue that's going on between two worldviews, an exclusive worldview of Israel as the chosen people, exclusive of others, and then the idea of accepting others through such stories as Ruth. We've got a dialogue in the book, as there is a great deal of direct speech as Jonah speaks to the sea captain and the sea captain speaks back to Jonah. And then, of course, at the end, the great dialogue that exists between Jonah and God.
So you like the word great also?
Yes, indeed.
What about other types of repetition? I want to go back to the repetition part.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of a word that doesn't always show up well in the English translation, and that is to go down. Mm-hmm. We think of Jonah as going 180 degrees in the opposite direction from God's call, and we think of that somewhat horizontally. But the language in the original telling, and of course the writing of the book, is to go down. You have Jonah who goes down to the... Well, first of all, you've got the evil of Nineveh coming up before the face of the Lord, but Jonah keeps going down. He goes down to Joppa. You don't see this necessarily in the English. He goes down into the boat. He goes into a deep sleep, a word which in Hebrew has the word down in it. He goes down into the depths of the ocean, and the bars of the ocean are around him. And that's when God brings him up in deliverance in chapter 2. That kind of repetition, it seems to me, is remarkable.
It is. It's very important to the whole theme of the book, because we've got the journey of not so much a hero, but an anti-hero. Someone who is just going against everything that he ought to be doing. And he is an anti-quest away. Instead of seeking the face of the Lord, which is the great quest of the prophets, he is fleeing away from the presence of the Lord. An anti-quest from an anti-hero.
I wonder if the first listeners wouldn't have picked up from the language, for instance, of going down, that we know where this story is headed.
Yes.
Just by the subtle repetition of the verb, to go down. I wonder if they wouldn't have picked up on that. I mean, okay, we know where this is headed. We know where Jonah's going, and it's not good. It's not up. So I wonder if that's part of it. I think about the repetition of God's, well, of things being hurled to the sea. God hurls a wind to the sea. The mariners hurl their goods to the sea. They hurl Jonah to the sea. And again, we don't see that in English.
It is a powerful verb. And, you know, a story flows. It moves on the basis of action. You know, God begins the action when he says to Jonah. And Jonah continues the action, the conflict is joined when he rises up and goes the opposite direction. And then the action is powerful action, and with strong verbs, hurl being one of them. God hurls a storm.
That's an interesting idea. And I suspect that the poetic imagery or the narrative imagery here would be so gripping. I mean, you could have used other language.
Right.
But these inspired storytellers and writers were careful in their use of literary conventions in order to persuade and to entertain us.
They raise the question, what is going to happen next? What is God going to do next? When Jonah flees, what will God do? Will God let Jonah get away with that?
Well, in some ways, it almost seems to be a passionless escape. He goes, buys his ticket, goes on the boat, and goes to sleep. I mean, what kind of a prophet is this? His conscience isn't even bothering him.
But it's told with a flurry of verbs, of strong words, where he rises, he goes, pays his fare, goes on board, to go with him to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. So it's an action that is told with just a repetition of verbs, just strong flurry of verbs.
And I wonder, Alden, if... even if there were some of the passionless, especially just going in there and sleeping, that the storyteller is not letting the audience think that it's only superficial and it's only passionless, because he's got Jonah going down, and it's really down, and there seems to be no bottom to this until we finally get the psalm.
Well, the other amazing contrast here is that the good guys in this story are the foreigners. These mariners, very devout people, seeking their God, and as soon as they find out who's caused the storm, they worship
that God. too. So.
And Jonah quite cheerfully says, oh, well. But then the Ninevites, so you have the mariners and the Ninevites both responding very positively to Yahweh's initiative. and Yahweh's prophet.
Now, does this give us any sense of the structure of the book? This is a kind of a literary question, Bev, but chapter one, you've got foreigners, and as Alden has pointed out, they seem to behave quite well toward God. And then in chapter three, you have the Ninevites, who tend to respond quite well. Things are happening in chapters two and four that are parallel. So maybe we ought to pay attention to that, too, as we consider the way the story is being told.
Because as we look at the end, you know, you can almost think of it in terms of four scenes. You know, the first scene happens on the boat, basically, on the sea, and then in the belly of the fish, and then in Nineveh, and then finally
outside
on the hillside, outside of Nineveh. And in this first scene, it's wonderful that the pagan sea captain calls Jonah to do his duty, calls him to pray, stand up and pray, do your duty.
Alden, I want to ask a different kind of question, having to do with theological, cultural background to this story. The ocean, the sea, was more than just the water out there. I mean, we pretty well know what happens. We know the physics of water and ocean and so on. What did it mean to the ancients? Was this just a matter of being scared because the waves were high?
Well, it often was personified in other cultures as deities. And even in Genesis 1, where you have the creation account, it's quite careful that the Lord placed limits on the sea. It can't come and get you. And so the sea is a pretty frightening thing, and for Jonah to be asked to be thrown into the sea is really quite amazing. So it's rich with symbolism, dark, ominous symbolism in the Old Testament.
Deities and disaster and chaos. In fact, you have a number of references, Job, a couple of the Psalms, Isaiah 51, to this battle. It's a creation story from the Babylonians. But in the biblical stories, God is the one who does it. He slays the fleeing dragon, and that's the ocean. The ocean is a source of danger and threat, but God's in control. So that reminds me about something else. What about these other deities? I mean, Do the Bible writers assume that there are other gods out there?
Well, this is an interesting transitional story, Doug, because you have certain stories. The most interesting one I find, the story of Naaman. He's from next door Syria, but to be healed of his leprosy, he has to come down and pray to Israel's God. And it's really quite an amazing story. So you have the idea of national deities. But in this story, it's a very curious one. Yes, you have the plural deities, but Jonah, a long ways from home, still identifies his deity as the creator of heaven, sea, and earth. So he's making a pitch here. My God is the big God. See, the one who made all of these.
So but the existence of others isn't denied.
Oh, no. It's affirmed, very much so.
The significance of the one.
But this is a powerful story. Yahweh is in charge of Nineveh, the mariners, and the sea.
To conclude, if the surprises of the opening scene of the story of Jonah are any indication, we should probably prepare ourselves for the author's continued use of irony and humor to bring his listeners and readers to serious lessons about the God we serve. Thank you, Alden and Bev, for your help today. Next week on Probe, Bev and Alden will again be my guests as we continue discussing the story of Jonah, this time the Song of Thanksgiving in Chapter 2. Please join us again. My thanks to Steve Cochran, the producer of Probe, and to all of you for listening in. For Probe, I'm Doug Clark.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you may call 509-527-2194 or email probe@wwc.edu. Join us again next week at the same time for Probe.